Hi, everyone. I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Reason Magazine's editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Reason editor-at-large, Matt Welch. Hello, Catherine. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
Hello, world.
We're taping this the day after Memorial Day, and we're going to talk about the body-slamming brouhaha versus Nazi punching in politics, Donald Trump's big trip abroad to the Middle East and Europe, the TSA's proposed ban on laptops on planes, and the growing possibility of some sort of rapprochement, if not active alliance, between progressives sick of the Democratic Party and libertarians alienated by Trump and the two-party system more generally. Let's start with the body slam heard around the world. Greg Gianforte, a Republican running in a special election for Montana's sole congressional seat, assaulted Guardian reporter Ben Jacobs. Gianforte also won easily over the Democratic and Libertarian challengers. Catherine, what do you think of the whole way that this has been discussed, especially in response to a previous episode where Richard Spencer, one of the, I don't really want to call him intellectual architects of the alt-right, but a kind of neo-Nazi, got punched at various public appearances. You know, is this type of stuff, is there a reason to be talking about this in equivalent terms?
I think so. I mean, the idea that it is an appropriate response to someone to use violence against them if you just disagree with what they say enough, which is the premise behind the Nazi punching debate, right? It's not, okay, generally we agree we don't punch each other when we have a political disagreement. But if you really, really disagree, then okay, punching is all right. And of course, the trouble with that is that it's up to each person to define that line. And apparently, Montana's finest congressional candidate felt that that line was somewhere south of Ben Jacobs.
Matt, what do you think and I guess to kind of orient Catherine's question in a slightly different direction, do journalists deserve any kind of special protection, you know, from physical harm or from legal challenges? Are journalists a breed apart, or is this something that we really need to start thinking about in a much broader term? And, you know, starting with the Trump rallies, where there was a lot of pushing and shoving, and at times Donald Trump as a candidate kind of, I wouldn't quite say push, but he definitely encouraged people in his audience to kind of rough people up, where he said he would pay their medical bills. Are we going down a very strange and dark path here in American politics, or is this all really just very small ball stuff?
I don't know. I actually wrestle with that. You know, I think the general default for most people who consume politics and write and comment about politics is to over seek patterns. So it's very easy for people to say, in the wake of not just the Gianforte, I'm going to call it Gianforte. I prefer vowels at the
Gianforte.
End. Gianforte. Not just that incident, which was disturbing. I mean, the guy, there's two cameras right there. It's 24 hours before an election, and he just absolutely lost control. Not just lost control and body slammed the dude. And you know, according to the Fox News reporters, they also started wailing on him, but then lied about it super brazenly afterwards. And then kind of after he had secured the thing, he won the election. But not just that incident, but the awful stabbing in Portland that happened 4 or 5 days ago. It's very easy. And I've been in a lot of situations over the last 5 days doing TV where everyone just assumes that this stuff is on the rise, period. I am a pattern avoiding type of person, right? So I worry in the same sense that after 9/11, everyone assumed without any kind of pushback that there was a rise in hate crimes and that we're going through like a giant anti, you know, Islamophobia moment. We actually didn't. And it took years for people to kind of start acknowledging that. If anything, that kind of the backlash started like 10 years after that, which is a very curious thing. Shika Dalmia, among others, have written very interesting, and Kathy Young have written interestingly for that at Reason. So that's a preamble to say, like, maybe there is a pattern, but I'm loath to say that there is one. My tendency is to say that the responsibility for violence just lies on the person who perpetrated it. And so it's, we had a rageaholic in Montana who did this thing. And that's kind of the end of the story.
But
however,
but he's, I was going to say he's not just a rageaholic, and he's not just some asshat, Antifa, anarchist who's punching Richard Spencer in the head, the alt-right guy. I mean, this is the guy who's going to be sitting in Congress, right? This is like this should be a pretty big deal. I mean, this is you're going back to the 19th century, pretty much, to see this kind of violence coming out of politicians.
And there was an incident in Texas, too, where I believe it was a Democrat state legislator went against a Republican because the Republican was trying to rat out, illegal immigrants, immigration activists, and sicking ICE on them. And so one threatened the other with violence and reprisals and all this kind of stuff. It feels like this is on the uptick. And the way that I would look at it is not necessarily in the action itself. Gianforte, who I look forward to his one term in Congress, hopefully, and then he's bounced out for being a lying thug, but also in the apologetic reactions, not just by a handful of commentators such as Brent Bozell and Laura Ingraham and a few others like that you saw on Twitter, but especially among voters in Montana. There was a lot of reporters who were just walking around talking to voters about this who were voting for Gianforte, like, yeah, who cares? And that's a weird reaction to me. I think you should care when someone in power commits an act of unhinged violence against someone and then lies about it. And then, like, I don't think that's a shrug-worthy thing. And it doesn't have anything to do with an exalted place for journalists here. I don't think we need an extra layer of protection. The First Amendment is a fine layer of protection, as are criminal laws. And he's up against one, right? He's got a misdemeanor assault charge going up against him. But there is a sense out there like, yeah, come on, this is a boys will be boys kind of a response to this out there in the body politic. And with the increase of polarization here and the way that people are embracing whatever, kind of a whatever it takes moment, like, whether it's a Trump apologist side that anything that he does, well, that's just the media and the deep state going against him. So he's my guy. And then on the opposite side, anytime he farts, that's going to be the new, poison stink bomb that we have to do something against. That kind of thing is going to lead, I think, to more sort of street violence or apologetics for street violence. The fact that people were seriously debating for a while the ethics of whether or not it's okay to cold cock somebody in the face while they're doing a TV interview was an incredibly disturbing moment, as were the apologetics for this assault.
Catherine, did you, Gianforte is kind of an interesting character too. He has an advanced degree from Stevens Institute of Technology, located in beautiful Hoboken, New Jersey. He also has an honorary degree from there. He's quite accomplished as a educational software developer, and he's got a big family foundation that gives out tons of money. He's also super anti-abortion. He's anti-drug legalization. He's against minimum wage hikes. He believes in, recent creationism. Does he add anything good to the mix of people headed to Congress?
I think that there's sort of two separate questions here. One is the question, like, will he basically vote the way that I like in Congress? And, the list that you just made there sounds like a mix of good and bad. But I think the tendency on the part of these people that Matt cited to kind of jump to his defense, to be anti-Gianforte, is, it is fueled by ideological agreement or, sort of the sense that he's on red team and they're also on red team. But I actually think you don't have to have this be a trend for it to be a worrying underlying idea. And I guess that's the part about this that gets me. And the reason I think it's fair to compare it to the Nazi punching is essentially it's this conflation, which I would say guys like Greg Gianforte would probably accuse millennial snowflakes of doing, which is, I don't like what you're saying. It makes me feel unsafe, and therefore any retaliation is warranted. I think that's what he would say. I think he would say, listen, this reporter was up in my face. He was not actually attacking me, but he was saying words that made me upset and uncomfortable. And I'm justified in lashing out at that. And I think that's absolutely what the sort of rhetoric around the Richard Spencer sucker punch was. Not that I am not tempted to punch both of these guys, but I wouldn't do it because that's like the rules of polite society and the civilized world are that we don't punch people we disagree with. And it's not a special rule for journalists. It's a rule for everyone.
Gianforte also, according to Wikipedia, he also does not believe in retirement because retirement is not a biblical concept. And he is quoted as saying, the example I think of is Noah. How old was Noah when he built the ark? 600. He wasn't like cashing Social Security checks. He wasn't hanging out. He was working. So I think we have an obligation to work. The role we have in work may change over time, but the concept of retirement is not biblical. Matt, you're, in your late 500s? How does that kind of quote make you feel when, you know, that these are the people who are going to be, you know, deciding the fate of one of the, you know, most unsustainable federal entitlements in the years to come?
You're trying to make me like him. I mean, I think retirement, like illness, is a weakness, Nick. Like sunburn, as we've discussed offline.
Oh, yeah, and allergies. These are all moral questions.
moral weaknesses. Yeah, whatever. Who knows, man? I mean, Social Security is a hell of a lot more paid for or, you know, fiscally sustainable than goddamn Medicare is at this point. And by the time we're done with round 3.7 of Trump care, whatever comes out of that, I presume, is going to be is going to make Social Security look like a paragon of fiscal virtue going forward. I expect every congressman to believe at least a half a dozen things that I find just laughably awful, and that includes people I totally otherwise agree with. This is not surprising. And, you know, an upside of all this is that the Libertarian candidate, Mark Wicks, I believe his name is, who Brian Doherty interviewed on our site, got 6%, which is a nice number. It's more than, I think, what Gary Johnson got. Montana continues to be, along with Wyoming and a couple of other states, mostly in the Mountain West, a pretty fertile ground for Libertarian Party inroads. And, you know, you got to look for any upside you can in this grim two-party death verse that we are in.
Well, I just hope that the next Libertarian candidate can take a punch at the very least. Why don't we shift to Donald Trump's big trip abroad? It started off in the Middle East, where he inked a deal or approved in principle a deal to sell a lot of weapons to the Saudi Arabians. He also talked a bit about how the U.S. is going to be taking care of the U.S. first, and that people in the region of the Middle East are the ones, those countries are the ones who have to stop extremists. He moved to Europe, where he was in between shoving various members of NATO out of the way so he could get to the front of the picture line. He rankled a lot of people, especially Angela Merkel, who has said publicly, and a number of other German officials have said, that Trump is really kind of peeing in the punch bowl there, and that they don't feel that the U.S. is a reliable ally anymore. Catherine, what do you have a summary statement about Trump's foreign trip, and what do you think was a good, bad, and different for the position of the United States throughout the world?
You know, I think he would say it was a huge success, right? To have Angela Merkel at the end of this trip say, we Europeans really must take our destiny into our own hands. We have learned that we cannot fully count on others. Like, that's what he wanted. That was his point. So in some sense, this was a very successful diplomatic mission. He went over. He said, like, guys, here's the new state of affairs. And it's clear that he was heard. I also think, you know, there were obviously some little, you know, one day kerfuffles as part of this trip, the wedging his way into the picture thing, the hand slap by Melania, which I have to say, like, more and more, I think that woman is just my spirit animal. I'm very into her. But the idea that so many people really, really wanted him to fuck up, and he didn't fuck up that bad. He did pretty well. And in particular, in conveying this message that the U.S. is no longer going to, you know, be this sort of eternal mommy and daddy filling the bank account of NATO forever and ever. Amen. You know, I think that's a legitimate point. I don't think he did too badly.
I think that you have to separate out the effects of diplomatic efforts or this trip And then also the performance of it, which might seem kind of strange at first glance, which is to say, yes, they did get that message. And I totally agree. Like, I want Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron to say, look, you know, Europe's going to have to take care of itself, damn it. I don't see that result as a fail. I see that as a success. But let's also talk about how he got there. He got there in part by saying Germany owes NATO and the U.S. money. This is a lie. It's the head of the free world not knowing how stuff works on a basic human level. He upbraided, and he did it again this morning via tweet. He upbraided Germany for having the temerity to have a trade surplus with the United States. This is like admitting that 1 + 1 = 3, damn it, and someone's got to pay for the arithmetic not adding up, or even, I don't even know, Catherine, sorry, this metaphor again, but he doesn't know what he's talking about. So when people get to this point that America is no longer a reliable ally and that it's favoring, it's more friendly in some respects, or at least less directly critical in some respects to Russia than it is to the head of Germany. And you get there by saying bullshit. I'm going to call that a half win. The other thing that he did not do, and this caused a lot of upset among Europeans. And let's set aside for the moment whether we think NATO should exist. I am an outlier in the libertarian world of those who thinks that it should. But all the European partners went in saying, I want to hear from the president of the United States that Article 5, which applies for the common defense in case one of the NATO members gets attacked. We want to hear assurances from him, since he indicated to the contrary on the campaign trail, that Article 5 is still a thing. He did not do anything like that. Later, his people did. The other surrounding diplomats and other U.S. officials said that, but he did not say that. If you're going to have a NATO and your NATO partners are worried about this thing, I would argue that it's a mistake. Or if you're going to have an Article 5, I would argue that that was a mistake. But I can see how other people might think that that is just peachy.
Well, let's if we go to actual facts, though, I mean, the idea is that NATO countries agree to spend 2% of GDP, I guess it is, or their budget, rather, percent of GDP towards defense of 2%. That target is supposed to be fully hit by something like 2024 in the current time. And the fact is that Germany only pays, and I'm looking at a PolitiFact article on this, which said that Trump was wrong, but Germany spends 1.2% of GDP towards military spending. They don't actually spend it. You know, it's not something they owe to NATO, as if NATO has a big store that you go and put a check in, or a bank or anything like that. But I do think that there's a claim there that very few countries, it's only like 3 or 4 or 5 countries in NATO actually spend 2% or higher. Most of the members are below, and that, in that sense, I think, you know, he's accurate that Germany.
And nobody's expectation for this trip was that Donald Trump was suddenly miraculously going to step off the plane well informed about U.S. foreign policy,
yeah,
right?
But, I mean, no, that, but he is right. NATO countries are not doing what they have agreed to kick into their defense, which then becomes, you know, in the aggregate, NATO spending. So it is right. Kind of, I don't see a problem with saying that, you know, to Germany, which is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. And one of the reasons why countries like Germany and Japan, in a different context for many years, they could actually spend more money on productive things. The fact of the matter is that military spending, as people like Veronique DeRougie and Robert Bauer have pointed out in the pages of Reason and elsewhere, military spending is actually a drag on the economy of the country that spends it. It doesn't actually increase GDP. There's a less than a dollar multiplier effect. And so the less you spend on military spending, you actually can have a more flourishing economy. And so I got to say, I think, I think Trump's onto something here, and that we're weaseling around, the problems, which is that the U.S., for a lot of self-interested reasons, has spent tons and tons and tons of money essentially occupying or semi-occupying Europe since World War II because of the Soviets and then because of other defense treaties. But yeah, you know, Europe should be picking up the tab for its own defense, especially if the boogeyman is Russia. You know, right. It's like, that's not our problem.
Right. But this gets back to the, you know, good effects, bad way of getting there. The actual accurate good claim is Europe needs to do more to defend itself. This is not the U.S.'s job. I totally agree. And that's great. And his browbeating will, I think, lead to people getting quicker to getting to their 2% levels. All well and good. That doesn't mean they owe us money. That's the wrong way of looking at it. And the other thing about Germany and Japan, we didn't want them to spend money on the military. That was by design until this century, essentially. We were still tetchy about Germany building up any kind of military as recently as the 90s, and Japan too. So, you know, there's the U.S. wanting its allies to get up to 2% is a semi-recent development. It's happened in both presidencies, to be sure, but it wasn't even the entire span of George W. Bush. For a long time, because of the aforementioned self-interest, we were kind of okay with Europe not spending that much money, because that meant that we got to decide about anything having to do with the world shipping lanes and all this kind of stuff. So yes, I want Europe to do more and to spend more and to collectively defend itself a hell of a lot more, but that doesn't mean that they owe us money. I think that's a different way of looking.
Yeah, I guess for me, the larger conversation, and I don't think that Trump is the person to lead it, because I don't think he quite understands it. But you know, if we take seriously the idea that the world is more dispersed, that power is more dispersed and decentralized, and I think it is, and I think it's generally a good development, but it does mean that the U.S. is going to be decentered from having to run everything or having to have a hand in everything or as big a hand. And I think you see with stuff like this, it's not a bad thing. And it's that it would be nice to have a president who could articulate that framework better, and also in a way that is perhaps more immediately effective. I don't know if we'll get there. I know we won't with Trump, because he's all about making America great again, and he doesn't understand, it seems, that in one of the ways to make America great again is to actually, you know, acknowledge that regional powers are going to have to step up, and a regional power could be NATO with the U.S. as a partner in it, or it could be China really flexing its muscles to keep certain parts of Asia in a kind of stable, peaceful, and productive way. And it could also mean that Russia has a role to play, that they all have spheres of influence. And I don't think America is quite ready for that conversation yet, particularly and ironically, because Trump is always talking about making America great again and making us the dominant country that forces our goods on countries that have to take them, and you know, we won't have a trade deficit with any country. I don't think he understands the incoherence of a lot of what he's doing. We can retreat from the world militarily without endangering American lives. We can spend less on defense. We can be a richer country, but we're not necessarily going to be the one dominant country or the indispensable nation economically, militarily, or I think even culturally.
I think one interesting reaction to Trump's bumbling approach, and that sense from the European point of view I'm talking about here, is Emmanuel Macron's press conference with Putin yesterday, which, you know, all of the Never Trump crowd is high-fiving. A lot of transatlantic type of people are saying, you know, oh, we finally have a new leader of the free world. He had Trump right next to him, or not Trump, he had Putin right next to him, and criticized the propaganda coming from Sputnik and RT. And in the case of Macron, that's, I think, more on point than it is necessarily even in the United States, which is to say that Sputnik there was the primary outlet for the WikiLeaks-style dumping, a lot of which was, I think, forged about Macron's, you know, secret Caribbean bank accounts and this kind of stuff. But he also hit Putin for meddling in Syria and for cracking down on gays and lesbians. Putin has never gotten that kind of dressing down in person as a world leader before, and was visibly uncomfortable. And it was clear that part of this was Macron saying, well, someone's got to do it. And to which I say, great, someone should ought to do it. You know, why does it always have to rest? There was a moment in like 2002 or 2003, I forget, after after 9/11, in which there was a dispute over some goddamn rock near Gibraltar or Morocco or something like that. Spain, England, Morocco, who knows? But there was just, it was a rock. And Colin Powell and the United States had to be in the middle of these sensitive negotiations about what to do about this goddamn rock. And it's like, you know what? We got to stop worrying about other people's rocks at some point. There needs to be a recalibration in which people are taking responsibility for their own affairs. And so a lot of people are looking at Macron and saying, oh, this is a rebuke to Trump. And I say, if that's what it takes, great. Because you should, France, take responsibility for your own affairs. And Russia is trying to influence things in Western and Central Europe. And that is primarily the responsibility of Western and Central Europe to do something about that. I would hope that we would help and provide some kind of assistance to that. And I don't think we will under Trump. However, the primary responsibility lies there. And if it takes a bumbling U.S. president to get there, I guess that's a cost we'll have to endure.
Wow. Okay. I'll buy that. Catherine, why don't we talk about a place where the TSA will bring it back to the United States and the Transportation Security Administration, everybody's favorite post 9/11 tumor on the body politic is they've already put a ban on laptops in the carrier, in the main cabins. For flights going to about 10 Middle Eastern, mostly Muslim-majority countries, they're talking about possibly extending it to all foreign flights coming in and going out of the U.S. because they're worried that that laptops are big enough to hide explosives in. What's your sense of that? Does the TSA just felt like it hadn't done anything really annoying and frustrating in a while, so it needs to get in the news? Or what do you think's going on here?
Probably. No, I mean, I think this is a great example where everyone is acting with totally good intentions, completely sincerely. I am sure that there is legitimate intelligence or something out there that is making this moment the moment of concern about laptops. I also think, though, that this is why you have to have as a baseline in all of these discussions. Well, what's the cost, even if it's a diffuse cost? I mean, the idea that now every international traveler, either to this specific set of countries or maybe more broadly in the future, has lost whatever productive hours they were going to have on those airplanes or lost the opportunity for entertainment. Lots of people just use their laptops to watch movies on flights. This is exactly the same kind of thinking that informs so much public policy, that the small cost to millions and millions and millions and millions of people is not worth considering. It's not coming up. No one is saying in this debate, hey, this is going to be really inconvenient for lots and lots of travelers in a way that suggests that they think it is a sincere rebuttal to this policy. And it should be. It is. I mean, this is true. Another sort of, I think, similarly controversial but real place that we should be talking about this is the distracted driving debate. The idea that you can't have your phone anywhere near your body in a car or else you will almost certainly immediately die and take everyone, all the small children on your street with you. That's not right. People, send a text at a red light. People make phone calls. Sometimes they don't plug in their headset. These are reasonable choices that reasonable people make all the time. And just because there is some risk in it doesn't mean you shouldn't make those choices. So I think this idea that the TSA is sort of fully succumbing to the, if it saves one life, it's worth it. That's wrong. That's wrong in this case. And it's going to be more and more wrong as the TSA tries increasingly invasive and sort of poorly targeted interventions like this. It's always been wrong.
Matt, what do you think about that? Because it is, one of the things that is disturbing to me is that if they're just talking about kind of generalized chatter, was always the word that used to be used, and a heightened sense of chatter and hence possible terrorist activity, but they don't really know, and they're limiting it to 10 or so countries. Don't you figure that the terrorists are going to rat around those countries and then do something else anyway? I mean, the idea that, if this stuff is super general, this knowledge or this information that they're acting on and implementing policy on, it just seems like it's a bad kind of hunch to really redirect everything, that all of us have to put up with.
just reading between the lines of the way that they've discussed this and the way that it's been reported, it seems like they got a pretty direct like communications that laptops are going to be the source of some attack, and they are freaking out about it and probably overreacting to it. And Catherine's right. Like for how long could we not use cell phones on airplanes? Was there any ever good goddamn reason to not be able to use a cell phone on an airplane to this day?
Well, the argument was that that the cell signals would interrupt or screw up various types of navigation stuff.
Right. And then suddenly it didn't, or at least it didn't too much except for a takeoff and landing. I think the default is always just to use this really crude, one-size-fits-all, heavy-handed thing. And, I mean, just look at the way that the populations on airplanes, and this is true of everyone who on this phone call who has a particularly younger children, people are pacified by laptops. Not only does it give you information to the outside world, which might come in handy if your plane gets hijacked or something like that, but it also just kind of keeps everyone calmed down. And there's a accumulated value of having that out there that I tend to believe is more than the accumulated threat level of these laptops coming down. I travel. If we're banning laptops on transatlantic flights, I'm screwed. So it's about me as everything is. And I mean, how are you supposed to go? Go to Europe and keep working or keep checking your email. I don't understand.
I mean, airplanes are also, and air travel generally is, I at least am frequently tempted to analogize it to a sort of little tiny authoritarian state, right? And I think we saw this with the huge reaction to the guy being dragged off of the United flight. You know, this idea that you're sort of in this metal tube, you have people who are perhaps not best suited to wield total power over you. And they make arbitrary rules and enforce them arbitrarily and not thoughtfully. And I think that's true of the TSA in this laptop case. But it's also going to be true that what we're going to be asking of the stewards and stewardesses and of the pilots, you know, Matt's right. Like, these devices pacify people. Again, you can, you know, your mileage may vary on how much you want to use as a metaphor for authoritarianism here. But at the very least, a plane full of angry people with basically nothing to do except for wait for their tomato juice is not a great scenario. And, I think that probably leads to more terrorism. Like, I would consider becoming a terrorist if I can't have my laptop on a flight. I think there's that as well.
My advice is also to get the spicy Mr. T's tomato mix.
Oh, yeah. Only a sucker would drink the plain tomato juice. That's crazy talk.
So there are 10 foreign airports, U.S.-bound flights, where you can't carry your laptop. Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Morocco, Qatar, UAE. If it stays with that, and given that I don't think any of us have been flying back from any of those countries, is that okay? And is it just that the TSA is constantly, overextending its reaction to things in a way that if it becomes all flights coming into the U.S. or all flights coming in and leaving the U.S. going to foreign countries?
Well, this is where they have us over a barrel, right? I mean, we don't know what they know. And they're always going to point back to that. They're always going to say, like, listen, we have intel that you don't have. Trust us on this one. But I find it very, very hard to construct a world in which that list of countries limiting a small, highly portable physical object from in and out of just those countries really minimizes the risk, right? Either the risk is a true, sincere, and severe one, in which case, take draconian measures and shut down all carry-on luggage, do whatever you need to do. Or admit that this is essentially security theater with a like lightly racist and discriminatory overtone on countries that are Muslim majority.
Without stepping into the whether it's a good idea or not, I would point out how the ratchet works. So I think in the San Bernardino attack, that was what, in the fall of 2014, sometime around there. And there was an immediate, 14 or 15, and I forget, and I'm sorry for not remembering exactly. There was an immediate move by Congress, some of which had been percolating for a while, but to tighten up the visa waiver program. The visa waiver program allows people who are citizens of 35, 38 countries to travel into the United States and for Americans to travel to those countries for 90 days without obtaining a visa. And so in the wake of this, they changed that rule to say, that still obtains except if you have traveled recently to Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya, and I think there was another one there, or if you are a citizen, a dual citizen from one of those countries. So it made this sort of little carve out there. That carve out became the basis of the original refugee ban and the travel ban from those countries. So say, hey, look, you know what? Under Obama, you signed this into law. So therefore, these countries are especially dangerous. So we can't have anybody coming in from there. That's kind of how these things work. And the visa waiver program, since it covers essentially all of Europe, and since Europe is now a center of kind of a steady drip by drip source of terrorism by people who are citizens of those countries, by which they have a right to fly into this country for 90 days visa free, you're going to find ever more creative ways to try to squeeze down the application of the visa waiver program. So on a laptop ban, starts with those 10 countries. I think unless there is sufficient outrage for it or something, that we can count on that expanding. And we've seen this in a variety of different ways. You used to be able to travel to Mexico and Canada without ever obtaining a passport. Now you can't come in the country without, a retinal scan and God knows what else. The technical restrictions on travel will continue increasing and ratcheting up. And I think this will happen regardless of who is the president of the United States.
Well, let's talk about possibly ratcheting up a different kind of action. Recently, the website Salon interviewed Nicholas Sarwark. He's the chairman of the Libertarian National Party. And the article was headlined based on something that Sarwark said, which I could take or leave, but it was talking about the role of third parties in national elections. And Sarwark said that the Libertarian Party and other third parties are in the position of blacks before the civil rights era was concluded and women before they got the right to vote, in that they have to try harder because they are not taken as seriously or not given the same place at the table. The Salon interviewer said he found that offensive, and then went on to list all of the ways in which he essentially agrees with Sarwark, that, among other things, that neither progressives nor libertarians, nor possibly even a plurality or a majority of Americans, are getting what they want or what they would prefer to see out of the current system, that third parties and the libertarians have a serious role to play in broadening the political discourse and the policy options of America, and that that we can't simply try to affect change from either within or without the two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. He signed off on Sarwark saying, when he asked Sarwark about wasting your vote by voting for a libertarian or another third party candidate, Sarwark, and I'm paraphrasing, said something along the lines of, if you don't vote for what you believe in, you're going to have whatever the two major parties have shoved down your throat. And the person basically agreed. What do you think about that? Is there a possibility, not necessarily overlap on specific policy, but on attitude from the edges of the American electorate, that that push towards some kind of alliance that might actually be effective in changing the way people kind of split up the political spectrum and or affect change within the Democratic and Republican parties?
I would start by saying I think that the initial analogy was a little bit unfortunate, although, attention grabbing and the worst publicity is no publicity, I suppose. I've always analogized what Sarwark was trying to say as the weird man's burden, which is those not just from, you know, third parties or whatever, but those who are kind of marginal characters who are on the ideological fringes of major parties. So your Justin Amash's and Rand Paul's and whatnot, that those people have an extra burden. They're assumed to be weird. And so they will be scrutinized to a degree, their performance, their comportment, their ideas will be scrutinized to a degree that a standard issue conservative or a standard issue liberal Republican Democrat would not be. And that is definitely a thing. The biggest interesting kind of poll that I've seen about anything over the last few months came, I believe, from Pew last week. And it was talking about they did a pretty in-depth look at different kind of blocks based on ideology and age, and tried to see whether or not people had shifted in their affiliation and kind of ideology and affinity with various political parties since December 2015, I believe it was. And basically, most people, they said, okay, you know, they're more or less in the same position. There was one huge outlier there, and it was among people who in 2015 were millennials who identified as Republican or conservative. They, in gigantic numbers, defected and flew away from the Republican Party. That's pretty interesting. That lines up with what we already know about millennials, which is that their one overwhelming kind of political value is that they are against the bigotry, or they're against, you know, anti fill in the blank ism. And they see in Donald Trump, and I think with some accuracy, and the kind of Trumpism around it, a hostility to otherness that they find kind of permanently off-putting. So that would suggest that there's a lot of peeling off ability there. And also, you know, just in general, all those numbers that you and I talked about in our book, Declaration of Independence, of self-identification with independence, those trend lines are going in the direction of more and more people identifying and affiliating with independence rather than the two political parties. I think what the curveball in all of this is that people are still, when it gets down to particularly presidential voting, but also in cultural response to things, to political news, people are still motivated by hate for the other side. And so that can easily be confused for affinity for their own team. I'm not sure I see a lot of affinity. I mean, Democrats are going to benefit from the pendulum swinging. And even though they've been losing a lot of these special elections, as they did in Montana, they're moving in a positive direction by 15 percentage points compared to what Donald Trump won those districts by. And I think we're setting ourselves up for Democrats winning a lot of seats in the next midterms that will be confused with new enthusiasm for Democratic ideas. And I think that's a mistake. I think there's a large sense of dissatisfaction that is ongoing with both candidates and party, and that's going to be pretty fertile ground for all third parties, but particularly the third party that has put itself in this very enviable position of being the third party in this country right now, beating out the Green Party in absolutely every single state, and starting to peel off state and local legislators around the country.
Catherine, do you think that the Libertarian Party, which generally accords with two of the things that Reason and other poll groups who have done polling of millennials found, that millennials kind of the anti-up question that starts a conversation is that you should be generally pro-immigrant or pro kind of other, a multicultural America. The millennials are the most multi-ethnic cohort generation in American history, and they don't have any problem with that, and they tend to be much more friendly and welcoming to immigrants, legal and illegal, than older Americans. That's one, gay marriage, or kind of not even gay marriage anymore, but just like sexual orientation just not being a thing anymore. The fact that the Libertarian Party has been on the right side of those issues going for its entire existence, essentially, do you think that will help the LP actually grow or enough to affect elections, or to have an impact on either of the parties to kind of try and co-opt that,
you know,
and then build off of other things that the libertarians might also be interested in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea that the Libertarian Party should be reaching out to the left is not quite right. Instead, the idea should be to point out the thing that you just said, Nick, which is the Libertarian Party has always been pro-openness and anti-authoritarianism. And, you know, I think a thing that makes America unique is our idea of pluralism rather than secularism, or rather than sort of, you know, state religion. And that is a thing that, at least to my mind, looks ever more appealing in a world where, you know, Donald Trump holds power and is using it to do things like, you know, close down many of the beautiful doors into our beautiful nation. Also in which people who identify as others or as minorities are afraid. I don't know that he's actually done anything yet to merit that fear, but I fully believe that he will and could over the next few years. I think the idea of, you know, not okay, now let's give the power back to the other guys who are going to use it to bludgeon the people you hate right now, but instead let's think about how to roll that power, you know, out of the hands of anyone who's in Washington or in the White House. I think that's a message that can work. I don't think it should be confused, though, with an alliance with the left or with progressives. The left doesn't believe that. Libertarians believe that. And it's a different thing.
Yeah. And, you know, picking up on that, I think there's also a serious, there's a role to play both for small L libertarians, such as those of us at Reason, as well as capital L libertarians, and, you know, fiscal conservatives and social liberals to the extent they exist in the Republican Party, which is to fill out the larger implications of if you believe in pluralism, which I think is, you know, in evidence if you are welcoming to immigrants and comfortable with, you know, with a multiracial America, you know, which is constantly breaking down into smaller and smaller groups that are more and more individualized. So it's not simply there are blacks, there are whites, there are Asians, say, but rather all of these groups are mixing more and more and becoming more and more individualized. In a way that Matt and I talk a lot about in the Declaration of Independence, but also sexual orientation, just not being a focus of public policy in the way that it has been in a very punishing way for centuries in virtually all countries, but that there's an economic and kind of commercial and cultural component to that of when you look at the Democratic Party, you know, they're not good. It's not just that they're not good on economic regulation, but they don't understand innovation. And I think it's really worth trying to come up with a way to explain to millennials, say, who want the freedom to be whoever they are, to act whoever however they want, to eat what they want, to smoke what they want, to sleep with whom they want, that certain types of policies don't allow that. And when you look at somebody like Bernie Sanders, who was popular among young people, Hillary Clinton won the youth vote against Donald Trump very handily, but she, you know, she's against the gig economy. She's against Uber. She's against Airbnb. She's against certain forms of Yelp and other kinds of social media that spread unauthorized, unaccredited information. She is not a person, you know, she clearly is more welcoming to immigrants at this point in her career than Donald Trump is. She is better on marriage equality than she was a few years ago. But they're not going to create a world that millennials otherwise want to live in, except on a couple of small issues. And in fact, when they start railing against saying, you know, well, you know, Airbnb hosts have to be exactly like hotels and they have to pay wages and Uber and other ride sharing services and a whole host of really important things coming on, or, you know, even with something like net neutrality, that the idea is that the government has to call all the shots on internet connections. That is not going to give you a cell phone with an unlimited data plan where you can listen to Spotify, watch Netflix, and do all sorts of stuff without having to pay massive amounts of charges all the time. And I think that that's a real opportunity. It's not really an opportunity for us. It's a responsibility for libertarians, small L and big L, to really kind of explain that these systems don't happen without certain types of policies, and that if you like the kind of weird food that you want to eat that doesn't require massive startup costs because you have to comply with all sorts of health codes, which are mostly BS and are just the residue and accretion of interests going back to the 1920s and 30s and 40s, where incumbent firms that exist, can kind of keep newcomers out by making it harder for them to start. That's the kind of message that we need to be sending, I think, from the libertarian quadrant of the political map. Matt, do you agree with that?
In that sense, a couple of battlegrounds will definitely be on net neutrality, which if you I presume if you polled, a bunch of millennials, they would not share our enthusiasm for Ajit Pai. They would think, because it's a very successful branding term of net neutrality, makes it seem like something that I would argue that it is not. So that's an argument that we have to keep on making. And the other area is the extent to which the Democratic firmament is aligned against Betsy DeVos and therefore school choice, therefore any kind of like alternative forms of education, backpack funding and whatnot. This is a chance for the regressive left to try and try to recruit millennials into being lackeys for the teachers union. I think that there's an instinctive sense, because a lot of these kids actually grew up in alternative education environments. Certainly, it's a generation that exists now that didn't before. But that's an argument that you have to keep on making, because it's still shocking to me how Betsy DeVos became more of a hate figure than even Jeff Sessions did during the confirmation hearings. And I think part of that is that there is a more well-funded kind of interest group national politics when it comes to teachers unions. And part of it is that the Democratic Party, the kind of soul of it, has been moving towards the regulatory and economic left for a while now, whereas Barack Obama came in and appointed Arne Duncan, who's a school reformer from Chicago. And even though Race to the Top wasn't a very huge initiative in terms of dollars, it did go into the direction of having some respect for school choice and performance and things like that. By the end of his presidency, there was no more appetite for that on the left. Hillary Clinton was as regressive as anybody, and Bernie Sanders is right there with her. I mean, there's nothing worse in this world than charter schools and maybe private prisons. And so those are where a lot of these arguments have to be made. And one thing to point out constantly is, who are the people that are the biggest fans of charter schools? It's on the consumer level. It's people who are in poor and disadvantaged neighborhoods who don't want to be sentenced to their neighborhood school. So I have the impression that is going to be an argument that is going to be worth making again and again over the next few years.
Yeah, well, to bring
those
it
arguments
back to
also center around the idea that you have to let people do stuff that you personally don't like. Particularly school choice. The boogeyman of school choice is, well, but what if there's a school that teaches something I, as the, urban young millennial voter, don't like? And that's absolutely going to happen. If you give money to private schools with religious overtones, they will teach children religious principles. If you give money to schools that are very regimented and disciplinarian, you will get schools that, in fact, use a different educational philosophy than a warm, fuzzy, progressive school will do. And I think this is the kind of broader question is, what is our appetite for difference and for letting people make decisions that we ourselves wouldn't make? And that the appetite for that is on the decline in Europe. It is noticeably on the decline. The idea of pluralism is out of fashion in Western Europe in particular, and that is in response to Muslim immigration. So the question of whether or not that's going to happen here and what it looks like here, I think America has some tools that Western Europe didn't have to ward that off, but it's far from a sure thing.
Well, and do you think, and we'll close out with this, to bring it back to the body slammer of Montana, Gianfort, is the Republican Party running and electing, easily electing candidates who believe that, a 600-year-old man shouldn't be retired, he should be building an ark, who is against abortion, who is against gay marriage, who is against immigration, That certainly is no way to increase the already paltry appeal of the Republican Party and conservatism to younger Americans. Is that something that the Libertarian Party and libertarians with a small L can, you know, is it, does it, you know, what is the best way forward in that? And is it kind of working to expand millennials' understanding of what it means to be a libertarian and that it's a system? It's not simply a kind of random spread of positions on issues that you may or may not agree with. You know, you might agree with 40% of libertarian ideas, so you, you know, but not net neutrality or not bans, you know, food bans on certain types of stuff. And I asked this of, you know, of Matt Welch, the editor at large of Reason, and Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor in chief of Reason Magazine, the print edition. You know, where do we need to be going and what stories do we need to be telling to broaden the appeal of a true freedom agenda that I think we all agree is actually something that would be good for the country, but also would be appealing to millennials and would be distinct from what they're going to be getting from either a traditional liberal or progressive or conservative or far right set of policies.
Bonnie Christine, I believe her name is, has a piece over at The Week from a couple of days ago that I recommend, talking about how she thought that this was going to be, writing from a libertarian perspective, she thought that this was going to be a great teaching moment, explaining why anti-authoritarian ideas and anti-executive power ideas would be very attractive and kind of winning the day, and that she's been chagrined that she hasn't seen that. She's seen instead just sort of a partisan sorting and then hysteria based on it. So I think that's a good acknowledgement that there is an uphill slog, and yet I still think that is very fertile ground. You know, whenever people, libertarians I know who were kind of doing the, hey, look, Trump might be like perversely good. One of the arguments was like, hey, Richard Nixon was perversely good because he helped kickstart a broad-based feeling of anti-authoritarianism and skepticism about power, both in terms of government wielding of it on the federal level, but also just on claims of authority, you know, claims that there is a best and brightest out there. And this led to, or this helped lead to, it worked in concert with a lot of pretty interesting kind of devolution talk and rolling back the federal government coming from both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, starting really with Jimmy Carter more than most people realize now. So I think there is going to be fertile areas to say, hey, look, welcome to the anti-authoritarian moment. We've been talking about this for a long time. Here are some tools that will help you survive not just today, but tomorrow and the next day, and a system for thinking of it. But we also have to keep in mind that it's a highly emotional moment. And if you don't connect people also on an emotional level too, you're going to be missing out on some arguments. And it's very difficult to say, hey, look, we're having fun over here, I swear to God, even though it's a pretty weird moment that we're living in here. And to try not to engage in nonstop whataboutism, even though my God, is it tempting with all these people. I just recommend don't follow the Twitter feeds of any high profile former Obama administration person right now, because it's going to make you want to reach through the Twitter machine and start throttling people in terms of foreign policy, civil liberties, God knows what else. It's very hard, but that is our noble uphill you know, duty and responsibility that we do gladly, is to make sometimes unpopular arguments, but allow people to come in through whatever door possible and make them feel, give them a set of tools to keep spreading these notions beyond just, you know, this week's news out of Washington.
Catherine, you're a millennial. Do millennials even know what doors are?
No, they're so far beyond doors, yeah. Man. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the idea of whataboutism, of course, can be taken too far, but I actually want to stick up for gentle, empathy-driven whataboutism as a powerful tool for libertarians. I think to just, at strategic moments, just say like, hey, you know how you really, really hate what the guy in charge is doing right now? So just try, if you can, to imagine if you held slightly different views than your own, if you might feel the same way if the opposite guy was in charge and bullying you in this exact same manner. I do think there's a place for that. I do think there's a place for whataboutism. And I think that's how you get people to the place where you say, you know, everyone in power uses it badly and uses it to bully people who disagree with them and always will. And you pair that with the, hey, we're having fun over here stories, right? The like things are getting better and better, which I believe is true. But I think you do have to do the doom and gloom story. You do have to say, you know, things are bad all over. And you should keep in mind, if you feel that way right now, there were people just like you, except on the other side of the political divide, who felt this way through Obama's term. And maybe instead of just going back and forth, taking turns, feeling like shit, we could work out a different way.
Well, on that upbeat note, let's end this episode of the Reason podcast. For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of the print magazine. Catherine, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
And we've also been talking with Matt Welch. He's editor-at-large of Reason, and he's also one of the co-hosts of the Fifth Column, a podcast that's available on iTunes. And Matt, when does it appear on SiriusXM?
On the weekends, at 11 in the morning on Saturday, 3 p.m. on Sunday, and then sometime in the wee hours.
Great. And you also, whenever it gets posted for free, you put it up at Reason.com. So please check that out. I want to thank you all for listening. Please subscribe to the Reason podcast at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We love to know what you're thinking about what we're doing. Thanks again.